Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and Manhattan. You are listening to BashaniRadio.com. New York City, always talking about everything. Yeah. It's not a game, it's a lifestyle. We global. BashaniRadio.com. New York City, always talking about everything.
We're taking over the radio.
Good evening, and welcome to another edition of Black Fire Podcast. It's the show where we talk to entrepreneurs about everything in the entrepreneurship landscape and issues that affect the entrepreneurs. Every week we want to encourage you to go to a higher level and do bigger and better things. You can learn more about Blackfire at blackfire.com. That's B-L-A-C-K-F-I-Y-A. Right here on the Bashani Radio Network. Get ready. Let's go. On today's episode, thank you for joining us. We have Dr. Herbert Harris. He wrote the book Solving the Race Issues in America. The purpose of Solving the Race Issue in America is to put forth a brief historical, spiritual, and psychological treatments of racism in America, its causes, evolutions, and possibilities for the future. Once we understand why we are where we are as a nation, then we are better equipped to determine what must be done to make America the number one nation under God, described as Dr. King's dream in the Pledge of Allegiance. Mr. Herbert Harris is an author, speaker, retired attorney, and a master of communications. So we invited him on Black Fire to really drop it down for you. Good morning, Mr. Herbert Harris. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great today, Doc. How are you?
You know I'm blessed and highly favored. I appreciate you, brother.
Hey, my dear. I appreciate what you're doing and the work that you're doing, really, to bring truth to the world.
Yeah, that's what we want to do right here on Black Fire Podcast on the Bashani Network. We're going to get right into it. Before we get into it, let just give people a brief synopsis of who you are. You was a retired attorney, and now you are dropping the knowledge around the world. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, you know, Benny, I came up in the 60s, in the 50s. I actually started college at Columbia University in 1960. And I came out of the segregated South. Never really had a meaningful conversation with a white person until I got to college. Wow. And so I came up in an era when, as a matter of fact, I went to high school with one of the Greensboro Four, and the Greensboro Four started the sit-ins, which really brought about the transformation of America and the, you know, elimination of basically segregation and public transportation. So I came in that era, the tail end of that era. So I experienced a time when black people were totally disregarded, discriminated against, and where we had to have our own everything, our own businesses. And that's why I love what you're doing with entrepreneurship. When I was a kid, every business you had was a black business, a black cabs, black plumbers, black electricians, because white people didn't want to do anything for you. And so I come out of that era. I moved into Columbia University as an Ivy League school. I got a scholarship to come to Columbia. When I went to high school, black kids didn't even take the college boards in the South. They had a different test called the merit examination. And so I was the first kid in my city to take the college boards. Okay.
Wow.
So growing up coming into that Columbia, New York environment was a completely different experience. I attended the March on Washington in 1963 and went on to become an attorney and really got to see different levels of the country, from the education level to see the, you might say, the discrepancies in education, the legal level, in law, when we look at the courts and when we look at the sentencing, the injustice that they're in. And then even in the music industry, you're in the music industry. And, when I came in that era when guys like Sam Cooke and, many of the black artists that, were hits, had many hit records, didn't have any money. Jackie Wilson died broke in a nursing home. And so, the music industry was one of those main industries that took advantage of black artists, et cetera. And then we move on to the present, where we see a civil rights agenda where states are trying to roll back election laws so that black people can't vote. It's a replay of what happened. I'm in Wilmington, North Carolina in 1898, the only successful coup, very similar to what happened in this country in January 6th, but this one was successful. The white people in Wilmington literally took up arms and eliminated an integrated, diverse government. And they set in motion a series of laws starting in North Carolina and spreading throughout the South to disenfranchise black voters, to take them completely out of the electoral system, to the point that in North Carolina, the last black congressman from North Carolina was a relative ancestor of my lady of Sandra, was George Henry White, who left Congress in 1901, 1902. It was 90 years before another black person was sent to Congress from the state. And so this disenfranchisement had complete effect throughout the South. And when we progress it all up to today, we see the same thing happening in mainly Republican-controlled states, where they're rolling back voting rights. And in Georgia now, it's illegal to give somebody a glass of water while they're standing on a line, where in the black community, you got to stand on the voting line 6 to 8 hours. In the white community, you can vote in a half hour.
Very powerful. All right, we got to stop him right here because we let him go. Herbert Harris, the whole show, he'll answer one question. We'll be like, what happened to the rest of them? All right. So,
yes, sir.
So, well, we got you here because of this big football mess that Brian Flores' lawsuit has brought to the NFL for black coaches crisis. It's at its boiling point, where he's accusing the NFL of, doing a lot of things that was not conducive to black coaches. And even in his lawsuit, he talks about being offered $100,000 for each game that the team lost in a bid to tank and secure the number one pick in the upcoming NFL draft. And this is really taking the NFL to a boiling point. And it's amazing that the NFL, Mr. Harris, is pretty much made up of, black and brown people, but yet there are no owners. Let's talk a little bit about this. What's your thoughts?
Well, there are 32 leagues, 32 league owners, and every one of them is white. The players in the NFL are roughly 70% black. Okay.
Wow.
So from that point of view right there, you got all the owners, 100% of them are white and 70% of the players are black. And so the NFL really is the present day reincarnation of a very unjust system. You might say a new reincarnation of a slave master mentality.
Just not the NFL now. Don't get it wrong, because there's a lot of other sports that there are not really a lot of black owners. I think maybe with the exception of basketball, right? Where they some people who have minority stakes in some teams, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Not a full out just owner. But let's start with let's stick to this the Flores thing here. Do you think he has grounds for his lawsuit?
Well, absolutely. And you know, the facts will reveal themselves. You know, one of the lawyers, a black man who was a lawyer and an agent for a while, he did an interesting piece when he talks about this Daryl McIver. And he represented many of the NFL players and coaches. And you know, so here's a man who's been on the inside dealing with it. And his basic comment was, it's about time. He eventually left the area because it was clear that the game was so stacked against black coaches, black executives, and black players that he couldn't even operate effectively. So it's something that's always there. It's like the country, you know, and it goes both ways. If you got a group, you think about this, you got 32 old white men. Mm-hmm. Predominantly older white men coming from a different era. You know, simply because we're in 2022 doesn't mean that their consciousness is in 2022. Many of them grew up in the era that I grew up in, where you had certain racist attitudes and you sort of accepted it. You know, it's like we were saying earlier, you know, you say, well, that's the way it is. You know, I can't do anything here. That's kind of just the way it is. And so you have that mentality still existing. Because the owners, the older people, still have that mentality, and so they perpetrate that in the operation of the sport. And the statistics, there's an interesting study that was done that the NFL, one of the things you find about the NFL and all these organizations, when somebody presents a problem, their way to handle it is the order of study.
So you mean they always want a case study to find out what's going on when they already know what's going on, but they want a case study.
When they already know, you know.
Wow, and so, that's crazy.
Yeah. And so they did in 2019, there was an analysis done. And when you go down the figures and the facts and the numbers and look at the 32 white owners and how the black coach right now, I think there's only one black coach in the NFL, which is Mike Tomlin, and how the other black coaches were treated. The interesting thing about this Flores case is that when he was saying that the owner asked him to, you know, lose some games so they could get a better draft.
In a bid to,
which is illegal, but when you hear that, it's almost it's like they've already made up their mind to get rid of that guy.
Right, exactly. So here's what I thought was interesting, Mr. Harris. In 1961 radio interview, writer James Baldwin encapsulated the black experience in America with a quote that continues to resonate more than 60 years later. Here's what James Baldwin said. He said, to be a Negro in the country and be relatively consciousness is to be in a state of rage, almost all the time. The rage is akin to a boiling tea kettle. It's not until after the kettle whistles that it's paid urgent attention. Brian Flores has reached his boiling point. The football world is paying attention. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. Benny, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to commission another study. I mean, you look, John Elway, made a statement basically, you know, in the statement almost claiming that he's going to bring an action against against Flores for defamation. You know, in his statement, he said, while I was not planning to respond publicly to the false and defamatory claims by Brian Flores, I could not be silent any longer with my character, integrity, and professionalism being attacked. And then goes on to say, you know, like we're looking at the presence of the word defamatory raises a question of whether Elway is considering suing Flores. And so What always happens when you have that whistleblower, when you have that person, the organization that he's speaking about always fights it. In other words, everybody knows that racism exists in the NFL, but right. Now nobody wants to admit it, so let's fight it. And the first way you fight is by counterattack. So they're going to be suing, but I would pretty much say they're going to start suing him, or that's going to be in their arsenal for consideration, because that's how they do it. Whenever somebody blows the whistle, one of the things that happens is they make sure, and Brian mentioned that he will never work again.
Oh, yeah, because he already know by him taking his stand, he's going to be blackballed. So even after it's over, even if he gets an undisclosed settlement, he will never be a coach again unless somebody that looks like him becomes an owner of a team and gives him that opportunity. He will effectively be the next Colin Kaepernick. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Okay. And the question I have is, why is that all right? You know, why are we as a country, a Christian country, a God-fearing country, why is that all right that when a person points out an injustice, that he's got to pay that kind of price? Wouldn't it seem that if we believed in our own words, you know, in our book in Solving the Race Issue, what we point out the contradiction there, that the first two commandments says, one, to honor God, and God is the creator. And the second commandment says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And in every church, it says, and on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophecy. But yet, we permit racism and things like that. Somebody points out injustice, and the system, the fact that the essence is racist, is that they then rear up and say, okay, if you point it out, okay, we know it was there, but you had the audacity to speak on it. And we may take some action to try to fix it just so we can get past this to go on to the next point. But you will pay the price. Now, why is that okay? The same thing happened, you know, in baseball. Remember Curt Flood?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Curt Flood, yeah. He was a baseball player. And when he sued, you know, for discrimination, he changed the nature of baseball. Every professional sports person should call him up and kiss him. Okay? Because of him, he eliminated his lawsuit. Although he lost the lawsuit, and although he was never able to make any money again in baseball, he changed the nature of the game. He changed the way the contracts were written. And he took it from that point now a free agency. So now, because up until Curt Flood, baseball players and sports people in general were treated like field hands on a plantation.
Wow. So he paid the price with his own career, but he actually changed the game. Do you think that's what's going to happen here? Or will this be a let it blow over and then go from there? Because, you know, he filed a 58-page class action suit that includes accounts of discrimination by three teams, one being the Dolphins, who fired Flores in January, the New York Giants, who he interviewed with during this cycle, and the Denver Broncos, whom he interviewed with in 2019. Together, they paint a picture of a league that has systematically failed in his black coaches and executives. Flores, you know, he was determined the only way to have real change is through the courts. Do you think we will have real change just like the case study we just talked about? Do you think they will make real change here, or will this be, let's everybody sue him and make sure he never works again, and we'll quiet down and go back to doing business as usual? Next time, let's make sure we don't talk to them face to face. We'll have an intermediary so they can never said we said this. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that the first line of attack is their counterattack to start suing them for defamation and everything else under the planet. That's the first line of attack. But until there's a spiritual recapitulation, and that's, you know, people who buy our book, Solving the Race Issue in America, when they read it, they say, well, what are you saying? And what I'm saying is, until you change people's hearts and minds, their spiritual identity, their value system, everything else is just window dressing. Example, in the South, in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, they said school segregation was unconstitutional. Integrate the schools forthwith, immediately. Where in most of the states throughout the South, they fought it. In North Carolina, it took 14 years after 1954 for the schools to be integrated. Right? So he said, well, wait a minute, hold on. What's up with that? The same people who fought the lawsuit to keep the schools segregated, once the law was enacted to say you got to integrate, they didn't get rid of those people who had fought it. They were still in charge. You see what I'm saying? So the same Board of Education, the same people that fought integration, once the law is applied, they're still in charge. And so they may comply with the law, but they comply with it in the same mindset that they had before. And so without that spiritual transformation of the people, it's just going to be window dressing. So here with the NFL, you got 32 white owners. You bring about the lawsuit, and even if the lawsuit says yes, they were discriminating. They did this, they did that, and all the law can say is now don't do it anymore.
That's not good, Mr. Harris. Hold up. Let's back up. Can you repeat what you just said? The lawsuit can only do what if he wins?
Don't do it anymore.
Oh my goodness. That was Herbert Harris, ladies and gentlemen, the author. Wow. The author of Saving the Race Issue in America. That was Herbert Harris. Just thought you should know. And you may want to go get that book at solvingtheraceissue.com. Okay. Wow. You kind of blew my mind. You threw me off for a second right there. Go ahead. Continue, my friend.
Yeah. Well, you know, the interesting thing, even if he got some money damages, you know, every money damage, you know, you think about it. When we have hurricanes in the South, we've had some terrible hurricane seasons. And so all of a sudden now everybody's shocked that our insurance premiums are going up.
Mm-hmm. So they always get their money back, right?
They always get their money back. So even if he gets money damages, you know, and believe me, the way the lawsuit is set up, it's a class action lawsuit. So it's not so much like, you know, I'm going to get some money myself. It's more like let us cease and desist in this particular action and maybe even penalize you dollar-wise for doing this particular action and tell you not to do it anymore.
Wow. So you're telling me that even if he wins, he's not necessarily getting any damages. Is that the understanding?
There you go.
So he did all of this and he won't get the damage and he'll be blackballed on top of that. Boy, that takes a courageous person. I got to give it to Mr. Flores. You know, the lawsuit says that the Giants only interviewed Flores to satisfy the league's Rooney Rule, you know, which calls for teams to interview at least two external minority candidates for open head coaching jobs. According to the suit, the Giants had already decided they were hiring before they interviewed Flores. You know what I mean? And that's because of that text thread between Flores and Patriots head coach Bill Belichick. That shows how the Giants had selected Bill's offensive coordinator, Brian Daboll, as the new head coach before Flores' interview. 3 days before Flores' interview with New York, Belichick texts Flores, "I hear from Buffalo and the New York Giants that you are their guy." Flores asks whether Belichick had meant to text Daboll, to which Belichick replied, "Sorry, I fucked up. I think they're naming Daboll." That's like the what do you call that? The flaming gun or what do you call it?
The smoking gun.
The smoking gun right there. So why are we even in court?
Well, once again, you know, you can catch somebody doing something, but until you seek rectification of it. You know, and people do illegal stuff all the time, improper stuff, but it only comes to light when you challenge it. If he did said nothing, then we wouldn't be having this conversation.
It would have been business as usual.
Business as usual. But think about this. There's a deeper meaning here.
Okay.
The fact that Belichick knew emphasizes that there's this whole level of communication going on between the 32 white owners and the people in power where they're talking to one another.
Oh, that's deep. Now, so without him making that mistake, that tells you they already had the conversation. They already had their pick and they had already talked to their key people or who got next.
That's it. And Belichick was a part of it.
Wow. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the opinions expressed here are not necessarily that of Bashani Radio or Black Fire podcast. These are strictly that of the guests that are speaking. Let's explain to me this. And I thought you was the perfect person to have on this show. What provoked you as a retired owner to write an entire book about solving the race issue in America? You know, despite it all, like, you can be writing about anything. You've done tons of cases. You've had a very intense experience within the law. What made you say, I need to write this and deliver this to the world?
Well, you know, Benny, because it's truth. You know, when I look at the law, when I look at the politics, I see that the country is in the same cycle it was 125 years ago in 1898. The same cycle it was when the Declaration of Independence and the Founding Fathers sat down. In other words, the country has not reconciled itself to the issue of racism and discrimination. It has not reconciled itself. And so when I see that and I look at what's going on around, I mean, the hatred in the air, the political, you know, taking away the people's rights to vote, some of the other many things, the discrepancies, you know, this whole pandemic has pointed out the discrepancy among, you know, the races. You know, I was listening to a news report and one of the state legislators say, well, before you get this particular drug, you need to, as a matter of fact, they were talking about some pill the next night pill or something. You see, before you
morning after pill.
Morning after.
that right there tell you that of Herbert is old school. He said the morning next, or you know, somebody next week, Tuesday after Wednesday. That just tell you I'm speaking to an OG right here. He don't know what he just said. He know what he mean, but the way he said it, you can pretty much forget that, bro. Yeah.
So they had a statement saying that, you know, before you can get this, you need to go and see your doctor. You got to get a doctor's permission. Well, among many minorities, many black folks, among many poor folks, going to a doctor is problematic. You know, to say go to your doctor, that presupposes insurance, which many people don't have, because a lot of folks don't have any type of insurance company. That presupposes that you have a doctor to go to.
Exactly. Okay.
Mm-hmm. That presupposes that you have the time to go sit. The last time I went to my doctor's office, it was a 4-hour ordeal. Okay.
Wow.
So do you have time to take off from your work to go to the doctor, if you have one, to spend 4 hours? So the point is, so many things we're doing now are lip service, but when you really look at the facts of life, they don't work. And they're hiding a fact that we have not solved this issue of racism in America. And so I wrote the book because I wanted to tell the world, if we are spiritual people, it's all written in the Bible what we need to do. Okay. That if we, and the first thing we have to do is, anytime there's been a wrong perpetrated against any person, okay, then there are three things you must do. Number one, you must acknowledge the wrong. Okay. This is straight from scripture.
Okay.
Number two, you must ask forgiveness for the wrong. Okay. And then number three, you must make atonement. We got to fix the whatever the wrong I caused you, I need to fix you up, make you whole. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what is happening right now in America, this whole idea of critical race theory, okay?
Oh, yeah, we about to go into that. Before you do that, because we about to get in here, we halfway through the process, so you made a great transition. You didn't even know I was going to go there. But ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Black Fire Podcast right here on the Bashani Radio Network. You can learn more about Black Fire at blackfire.com. That's BlackFiya.com, the business of entrepreneurs. And we're speaking to Dr. Herbert Harris, an extraordinary retired attorney and also the author of the powerful book. And you need to make sure you go grab your copy, is Solving the Race Issue in America. You hear me? And he's dropping it. So you did a great transition, like you already knew what was going to happen. And let's move on over to this critical race theory that's going on, where a lot of black authors seem to be suffering because a lot of their books, especially in Texas, are already being banned. Books that have been around for a while, and now people are saying, it almost feels like in the world we live in, this digital landscape, if you make somebody feel bad, then that's the cause for, you know, if you tell the truth, but if it makes certain people feel bad, then we don't want it around. Talk to me, Mr. Harris.
Well, once again, this is the spiritual dilemma. Because if you don't want to acknowledge it, the way to avoid acknowledging it is don't talk about it.
Ooh,
to act deep. As though it didn't happen.
Ooh.
Okay. Now, when you think about this, I think one of the things that scared white people was with the George Floyd experience. When you look at all the demonstrations across the country, you saw diverse people. You saw young white people, young black people, young Asian people, young Hispanic. You saw young people out there saying, hey, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. Nobody should kneel on somebody's neck 9 minutes and kill them right in front of the world. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Absolutely.
That's just wrong. And I think that the powers that be saw that and they go like, wait a minute, these young white people are plugging into a truth that we've been trying to hide all these years. They're saying, they're questioning the system. They say, well, why is this right? Why is it okay for somebody to do that?
And the people who are questioning are their children.
Are their children.
And that's where they begin to get in an uproar.
And there you go. And see, that's the whole thing. Because once the children question it, then they want to know. And once the children know the truth, many of the white children say, man, this was wrong, man. And, you know, I acknowledge this was wrong. And I'm going to come out here and stand on the picket line with you to show you my commitment. Okay. And so the way to neutralize that is to don't tell them. To perpetrate a lie, to perpetrate a vibration of ignorance. You know, I mean, they've done it unofficially. You look at Wilmington, North Carolina. I grew up here, and I didn't learn about 1898 until I was, almost 60 years old.
Wow.
Okay. Wow. You look at the people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with Black Wall Street. Here, it was at 1921. So for the first 80 or 90 years, nobody knew anything about it. They covered it up. But then it was like a quiet cover-up. And you know, the phrase you often hear from white people, they say, well, that's the way it is. And so they covered it up quietly. What's happening now with this critical race theory assault is it's public now. It's not just something we do behind the scenes now. State legislatures are saying, we want to control what you read because we don't want you to read about the true history of what was done in this country. Mm. And the whole excuse, I don't want my kids to feel bad. Okay, that's just a smokescreen. The people who you throw a rock into, well, let me not even use that analogy. That might be misinterpreted. But the whole point is not the kids are going to feel bad. It's the parents that don't want to acknowledge what has happened. If the kids are taught the truth, they're going to feel compassion. You know, slavery was ended not because black people went out and fought, but it was ended because good white people said, hey, slavery is wrong.
Please repeat that over again. I don't think they grasp that. Can you repeat that over again? Slavery ended because what?
Slavery was ended not because black people took up arms and said, I want to be free. It was because good white people, the Quakers and many others, said, hey, slavery is wrong. It's a sin before God. It's a sin before man.
So it took a nation of people to make that happen.
There we go. And see, that's the paradigm that can change the country. When white people and black people can acknowledge the past, okay, number one, ask forgiveness for the past. If it was wrong, it was wrong. The moment you don't want to ask forgiveness, that means that you really don't think it was wrong. You know, but I didn't hang anybody. I didn't do anything. But your ancestors did. And so the forgiveness is an acknowledgement yourself that, hey, it was wrong. And if I were in their place, I wouldn't have done it. That's really what forgiveness is saying.
Okay? Mm. And then make cause to change it. And that's what happened and that's what happened in a lot of things. So, you know, to speak to that point, then I think you said one of the biggest solutions that has to happen. Good black people and good white people have to come to terms together and change the things that are unfair to others.
Absolutely.
One culture can't do it by itself. It was deep when you said that even when black people took up arms and said, I want to be free, I want to be this, it wasn't until good white people came in and said, you know what, this is wrong, and we should honor that request. So what does that say for America where we're at right now? So that sounds like the only way we're going to have a solution to racism when we have just as many good white people and good black people teaming up together to change the way business is done.
That's why the civil rights era worked. When Dr. King was in the Birmingham jail, man, he was like, man, this is not fun. Okay. And he wrote the letter from the Birmingham jail. A lot of the rabbi, there's a great rabbi that responded. A lot of the white ministers and white spiritual people and white people responded and say, yes, we support you, Dr. King. This is not right. Let us do what we can to change it. And that's why the civil rights legislation, I mean, I attended the March on Washington. And, you know, they often want to underestimate it. I was at the March on Washington. I was at the Million Man March, the Million Family March, and the inauguration for President Obama. Okay. Mm-hmm. The Million Man March, the March on Washington in 1963, was the biggest of them all.
Hold up. The Million Man March was in 1963?
Dr. King March, the March on Washington.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right.
Yeah. Because now I saw them all, and they'll tell you about, but for those who were there who saw it, I remember those people stretched from one monument to the other, all the way up to the Capitol. There were no, you know, like holes in the ground and whatnot. And, you know, anytime if they estimated, they say, oh, there was like 250,000 people. If the official white press estimated 250,000, then it must have been a million.
The opposite that happened was when Trump says who's in his audience, right?
Yeah. When you look at that, we didn't have an aerial photographs at that time, but having been there and seen it, man, it was nothing but a sea of people. You didn't see no open holes. You didn't see, it was all people. But you know, something happened when I was down there, and I heard that speech, and it was the weirdest thing. I don't know how a microphone could carry that, because, you know, now somehow those words rang out there around the pool, around the in front of the monument. It was like he was talking right to you.
Very deep.
You know how a lot of times when you have a big place, you hear the echo? I don't remember hearing that. Like, all I remember was hearing the words like he was standing there talking to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, Mr. Harris. Mm-hmm. You said a major objective of the Big Read is to prepare the next generation of leaders to address the challenges that exist in a divided nation and determine where do we go from here, a way forward. Corporate and institutional sponsors are providing support for participants to encourage, you know, them in the positive ways to be part of the solution, right?
Yes.
So this book, how does it different from when you were coming up to where we are right now? And what I mean by that is, you said it was a long time before you had a conversation with a white folk, right? Yeah. Right. So you had yeah. your perspective of white and black interactions then versus you have your perspective of white and black interactions now. What did you learn back then that connects to what we are, the young people are at right now?
That's a very deep question, man. Back then, it was a revelation. You know, when I came to New York and actually had conversations with white people, I realized how starkly divided the culture was. In the South, you didn't speak to a white person. You didn't say to me, how you doing today, man? What's going on? Do you watch the news? You know, you didn't do that. It was all yes, sir, no, sir, get out of the way. You had no comment. And so when I came to New York and went to school, I realized that white people were just like black people. It was just about people. We were all students.
Mm-hmm. Where did you graduate from in law school?
I graduated from Columbia.
Oh, okay, yeah. Cool. Right here.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah, yeah. And see, I came to Columbia as a undergraduate, you know, from the South. But we had, in my class there, we had only 5 black kids and out of 725 students. And I think only 2 of us graduated. So it was a different world, but it let me know that people were people.
Mm-hmm.
When I progressed that up to today, when my daughter graduated from Columbia in 2014, like 50 years after I finished, okay, she graduated, and there were over 111, you know, students of color in her class. I think roughly 10% of the students were black people of color. And they had a whole different paradigm. The black kids and the white kids were hanging out together, and it was like one family. And so that's what I see today, that the young people have gotten, they have been presented with a reality as a result of the integration that took place in the 60s. The young people, the people today, the 40 and 50 year olds, have been presented with a reality that was based on, you might say, a diverse community. Mm-hmm. You still have the old guard who's trying to undermine that, you know, going against affirmative action and all that. But the young people, this next generation, if they have that same, these young people who are out there demonstrating, if they have that same understanding of humanity, that it's not white, it's not black, it's like human beings out there, and we should be concerned about one another, it will change this country. Mm. And that's very, very what powerful. This rebellion is about, to keep that from happening.
So is your book available in audio or just paperback?
It's available in paperback, and it's available in on Kindle. We don't have an audio book, but it's on Kindle and in paperback, and Amazon sells a bunch of them.
Oh, okay, in the Kindle format. Oh, okay. And mm-hmm. So if they want to get it in the Kindle, they go to Amazon.com and put in Solving the Race Issue in America?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and if they wanted to purchase the hardcover, where would they go
for that?
It's
on Amazon, too. Everything is right there on Amazon.
All right, but do you have a site for Solving the Race Issue so we can go directly to you?
Yes, www.solvingtheraceissue.com.
All right, ownership is what we're trying to do, brother. Okay, ownership is what we're trying to do. Okay, so solvingtheraceissue.com. That's where you should go purchase your hard copy, okay?
There you go.
He'll get it to you quick, fast, and easy. All right. Do you have autograph? You got. I was about to say that.
Yes,
so
sir.
if you go right to his site, not to Amazon, go to solvingtheraceissue.com, and he will send the autograph copies directly to you. As ASAP. Let's just say that, as soon as possible. All right.
You know it.
And go from there. So if you go for the autograph copies, that's going right to the man who made it happen. We got to support those people who support us in the things that we do. OK. And, you know, it's less expensive than a T-shirt that you bought that says something you ain't say. OK.
I hear you.
So solving the race issue in America, and then we're going to go on to this critical thing, because your book will probably be one of those books that are banned because just from the title. Okay.
Yeah.
probably will not be in the library. I can promise you that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I've already seen the effects of it. I've already seen that librarians, you know, because often library sales are a major part of any author's, you know, book sales.
Uh-huh.
And the librarians that I have talked to, you know, the librarians, many of the librarians are on hold. Anything that looked like race that might even possibly remotely be considered racial, they're afraid to order it. And so I'm already seeing that.
So what you can do, ladies and gentlemen, you can go to our resource page at blackfire.com. We're going to provide a direct link over to his site. And you go to blackfire.com and hit our resource, and we're going to provide a direct link where you can go and purchase the book, so we don't have to go around it. Or you can go to solvingtheraceissue.com. All right, because I really appreciate it. Let's go to the critical race theory, because there are a lot of authors just like yourself that are being banned. You know, in your description of your book, you said solving the race issue gives a powerful and concise overview of America's legacy of racism. It provides key information and fresh perspective needed to begin the healing process of solving racism in America. The book reveals historical and current truths about racism in America and offers spiritual solutions and process for curing this cancer in the soul of America. Is there really a cure for this cancer of racism?
Well, the cure is right in the Bible. It's right there in the description. It says, acknowledge it, ask forgiveness, make atonement. You know, the in a capitalist world where we live, atonement is the thing that they're really scared of. You know, you see the issue they had with the NC State, one of the colleges here, the lady, the sister who worked on the 1619 project,
mm-hmm.
That talked about racism and, you know, how many of the schools, that basically how racism was integrated in the fabric of America from the times literally that the pilgrims arrived here, 1619, when the people arrived in Jamestown. And so the university did not want to give her tenure. And one of the benefactors wrote something to the effect, he sent an email, something like that, that giving her tenure, that book that she wrote, that study, and it was commissioned by Time Magazine, by the New York Times, I'm sorry, that can set up a foundation for reparations. And so it always goes back, you know, in everything in a capitalist society, and I mean, America is a capitalist society, it always comes down to the dollar. And so a lot of the pushback from a high level, from a power level, from the people at the top of the heap, is the thought that reparations could be coming down the pipe. That if you follow the spiritual path, then it says acknowledge, forgiveness, atonement. And they'll confuse you by reparations. Like, I'm not giving you any money. It's not about money. Atonement means, what do I have to do to make it right? Do I need to put special emphasis? That was the whole idea of affirmative action. The premise for affirmative action is, if you have been discriminated against for 150 years, okay, mm-hmm. and you have been so far put down the line, down the ladder, then we have to do something special to bring you back up to par. It's not enough now to say, okay, the game is fair now. All right, you're on the 95-yard line, and everybody else is on the 5-yard line.
Wow.
So affirmative action was brought about to try to rectify that. But you see, there's a quote, and it says, "A mind changed against its will is of the same opinion still.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the spiritual essence of America, so the Voting Rights Act was enacted, but then they had sunset clauses on it, you know. So what are they saying? They say, well, there will come a time when you won't need it. Well, here we are over 50 years later, and we still need it.
You got that right.
But, yeah, but now you're trying to undermine it even more. And so what is really happening is that if we don't solve the spiritual issue, it will continue to happen. And we see it right now with the voting issues. With the there's a division in the country now. Instead of being racist, now it's a mask. You know, you got one group want the mask, another group don't want the mask. It's how to approach the pandemic. You know, is whether a major percentage of the people think the election was stolen. So whoever's running this show, somebody's running it.
Somebody's at the wheel with the puppet strings.
Somebody's at the wheel. This stuff doesn't just happen. But somebody's at the wheel and they're saying, you know what? We need to look at this. And as long as we can keep divisions, then people will never get around to solving the problem. So as long as we keep people fighting over masks, then they're never going to look at the spiritual issue of racism.
Okay. Oh, that's deep right there. Oh, you going in, Mr. Harris. You are going in today. Wow. Okay. But you know what? You're absolutely right on point. What do you think they are trying to accomplish with this critical race theory, and why all of a sudden has it come to the forefront?
Well, the powers that be realize that you take the things that are important to people and you turn them around. So nobody was teaching, you know, the school, nobody's really teaching. For number one, they don't even know what critical race theory is. Derrick Bell, who was an attorney, really was one of the first people to talk about critical race theory. And his perspective really had nothing to do with what they're talking about. His perspective was this: if you talk about race, then white people are going to be critical of it.
Oh, wow. So that's where all of this came from?
Yeah, that's really his perspective. And so
he proved this point then.
Exactly.
Because that's exactly what's happening right now. If you talk about race, white people will become critical of it. And voila, let's get these people down because look what they're talking about.
Right. But you see, they turn it around. So it sounds like critical race theory is that we're trying to teach white kids something that's bad about race. So, you know, one of the things that's happening right now, Benny, is that the power to define, the power of words. You look at the Russia right now.
Uh-huh.
Putin was saying we are not. His mantra is America is agitating to create problems, totally ignoring the fact that he has 125,000 troops, tanks, airplanes, ships on the border of this country.
Mm-hmm.
But he's telling his people that, hey, America is creating a problem. They want to declare war. They're the ones agitating.
Wow. So, wow. He's sitting right over there with his finger on the button, ready to go. Wow.
There you go. You see? And that's happening in every aspect of our life. It's happening in the political arena. You know, you have a whole group saying that the election was stolen, you know. I mean, a major percentage of the people in this country say the election was stolen, but completely ignoring the facts. You know, that every court, even the Supreme Court, validated the election. So what that is saying is that people can be taught things that are not true, and they will act on it as though they were true.
Wow.
And as long as we can.
Is that the old saying that if you tell a lie enough times, it becomes their truth?
That's the present day man of fiction. That's 2.0.
Oh, wow. Oh, wow.
Okay.
That's amazing. And you know what's scary about all of this? You know, we've had a good time talking about this, and I hope that some of the younger people will really take heed to some of the things you said today, because I think it's very important. The more you know, that the more you grow. But a lot of times,
Ooh.
You know
yes,
what I mean?
Sir.
A lot of times we are bombarded by so many things that distract what you really should be paying attention to, that you and the young people, they forget what they was out there for in the first place. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because, you know, if you distract them enough, they'll, you know, they'll forget why Black Lives Matter. They'll forget why voting mattered. They will forget why, you know, affirmative action mattered. If you if you keep bombarding them with other things and making them dilute what is really important to us, then we have a whole nother conversation. And before we get out of here, I really appreciate your time. Let's talk about reparations for a second. What would reparations solve if you gave African-Americans a certain amount of money?
Well, I don't think it's money per se. You know, it's more structure. It's more assets. So if I looked at reparations might be okay. Education, well, number one, if I looked at reparations, number one, I'd start with health care. I'd say, okay, right now we can demonstrate that poor people have shorter life expectancy. Poor mothers, black mothers, have a higher rate of childbirth problems. So let us put money into now making the healthcare system equitable. Let's you know, like some of these states are fighting Medicaid. Medicaid is like an institutional approach to giving everybody medical care. Okay. But you have states that refuse Medicare.
On the grounds of what?
On the grounds that one day, somewhere down the line, I mean, well, number one, it's really on the ground of racism and classism. You know, everybody forgets about poor white people. Okay.
And you know, so funny, there's a lot of them. And what I thought was ironic, that those same white people who were stomping for Trump were affected by the things until they realized that the very thing they thought they were fighting for was being taken away from them when it came time to go to the doctor, when it came time to, you know, get medication. The very thing they were saying we didn't need, they realized they needed. They didn't think it was going to affect them. They thought that it was a black thing, a Latino thing, until they went into the doctor and they didn't have insurance or they didn't have no medical care because you fought to get it erased. Talk to me a little bit about that, brother.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I think it's either Kentucky or Tennessee. One of them, the official posture of the state was they're against Obamacare. Had signs up, you know, repeal Obamacare. But then all the members of the people in that state have the affordable health care available. They go, well, wait a minute. Affordable health care is Obamacare. Oh, no, it isn't. Oh, no, no, it is not. Affordable health care is Obamacare, but you get people.
They don't even know what they're fighting for.
There we go. All right. So the one thing that whoever the powers are that control the country, the one thing they really fear is when poor black people, poor white people, and poor Hispanic people, the classism is a microcosm of racism. Racism is just like a functional thing imposing and implementing a classism. But the classism, the rich gets the poor, you know, that if we really look at it, you know, it's really when poor people, poor white people, and they're part of the most unrepresented group, because nobody, when you see a politician at a trailer camp, you know,
exactly.
Nobody, because they don't
pay attention to them because they feel like they're hidden in their trailer parks and nobody's paying attention. And because they're white, they automatically not going to have it as hard, which, you know, they find out very quickly. That's just not a true statement.
Well, what the powers that be is all they can, they convince poor white people that they're poor because of poor black people. And then
what? What in the world is that logic?
Okay. So if you ever look at the news, anytime you see a picture of welfare, people getting welfare and handouts, who do you see?
Black and brown people.
Black and brown people. Okay. You rarely see a picture of a white person getting welfare. So why is that? More white people get welfare than black people. That's the statistical truth.
That's what I heard. Absolutely. That's okay. What I heard. Absolutely.
But the picture is pointed like it's us, so that's just another means to divide us. So
you know we're going to have to come back another time because this is just much to digest. And, you know, who controls that narrative? The media. And which is why we don't control the media, you know. And, you know, we have to slowly push ourselves in there and become own, like, you know, like me. I fund this whole entire process in order for it to happen. You know what I mean? If we don't control the narrative, you don't control the story, you don't control the visuals, then your point of view don't really matter.
That's right. That's right. Because it's all, you notice how whenever there's an issue, there'll be a PR. I guarantee you that the NFL will be launching a serious PR campaign talking about opportunities for black folks in the NFL. Yeah. You know, so I think that the powers that be understand that, as the Bible says, it's not about bricks and sticks, it's about the mind. And so they realize that if they have the ability, the media controls people's minds. And that's why there's cell phones and everything. You know, there's no place on earth that there's not a cell phone. And that the people are fed an overdose of media thoughts. And so you can program their minds by what you make available for them to see. And so believe me, these major media companies are not just out there to make money. They're out there to create vibrations and create stories. And so the media knows that you can create a narrative, and as long as you capture a person's mind, you don't have to worry about their behind. If you got their mind straight,
that was deep right there. And I used to use that for women. I'd be like, if you can stimulate the mind, you can stimulate their behind. And you just changed it all around. You made it not sexy.
I just took out all the sex appeal.
You just took out all the sexiness of it. So, all right. All right, we're going to call this part one, ladies and gentlemen, because we're absolutely going to have Dr. Harris back. And I want you to make sure you go, and eventually maybe there may become an audio version, because I know how people get lazy sometimes. But I want you to go over to his website, and that's solvingtheraceissue.com, and purchase your copy. Read a book or something. You know, you ain't always got to listen. Read a book. You know what I mean? Go to solvingtheraceissue.com and purchase a copy of the book. And normally we will be like, you know, what do you got to give away, Mr. Herbert Harris? But today I think this issue is so important. We're gonna buy 4 copies, and we're gonna let people win them by just sending in and going over to Dr. Harris site or Instagram, or coming to Bashani Radio Instagram, or going to Blackfire, and just let us know why you think you need a copy of this book. If you can't afford it, we'll pay for it. It's just that simple. It's not a game. It's a lifestyle. All right. Your final thoughts, Mr. Herbert Harris.
Well, my final thought is, Benny, it's extremely important for people like you to do what you do. It's because you're able to control the narrative, because you put in the work. I mean, you didn't just wake up one day and somebody came along and said, well, here's the Shiny Radio, here's resources, here's money. You worked your tail off to get it.
Yes, sir.
And it's because of that that people like yourself are able to present a counter narrative, to present, they say, history is his story. Were you able to present your own history, our story, true story?
Amen.
And so my final words are to support what you're doing, to keep doing what you're doing, because making people understand the truth is what gives them their reality. What they believe in their minds is true is what they act on. And so controlling that narrative is a great power man. And so keep up your good work. I'm honored to be a part of it. I'm available whenever you want me.
People want to learn more about you. Where can they do that, sir?
They can go to the website, Solving the Race Issue, and you can go to my personal website, herbertharris.com.
There it is. Are you on Facebook or are you on Instagram?
I'm on Instagram on the DR Success Man. DR Success Man.
All righty. DR Success Man on Instagram. All right. We're going to get this episode out ASAP. All right. So everybody can hear it and be a part of it. And once again, Dr. Harris, I appreciate your time. I appreciate your passion. I appreciate your knowledge, because if we don't take a step, even if we change one young person's mind or drop a nugget in it, maybe they can take it further and change millions. Just like, you know, somebody gave Oprah a chance and then she changed the minds of millions. So hopefully, you know, Solving the Race Issue will be able to do it. And, you know, go over to blackfire.com, the business of entrepreneurs, where you can see a lot of people that look like you. You know, great stories of entrepreneurship and all those things involved. And we will also provide a link over there back to Solving the Race Issue in America by yours truly, Dr. Herbert Harris. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, here's what you need to remember. Everything is in your power. You can solve whatever you need to solve as long as you put action behind that. Dr. Herbert Harris shared with us Solving the Race Issue in America. And we talked about a lot of things concerning what's going on in our current times. It is these times and these moments that we have to actually sit back and say, what can I do to make a change? One person can make a change. Brian Flores showed us that. What it's the outcome, we don't know, but at least he brought the communications to the table. We know how things pan out sometimes, but I have an optimism that at the minimum, bringing light will help change the minds of those that are in power and those that are becoming in power. Because remember, all the people that are in power today will not be the people that are in power tomorrow. And if you can affect tomorrow's generation, then I think you have done something. And Dr. Herbert Harris, that's exactly what he has done. He is leaving not only a legacy, but he's leaving a legacy of information in solving the race issue in America. Long after he is gone, he will be still here in the words, and words are powerful, and those words are solving the race issue in America. And I hope that you will support this fine gentleman with what he's trying to accomplish in this world. And that is very, very simple: to enlighten the generation of the future. And if you can help one kid understand how powerful they are, then you have helped a generation of people. All right. I'm Benny Randall Jr. This is Black Fire Podcast. Make sure you join us at blackfire.com, BlackFire.com, or listen to more powerful episodes on Bashani Radio. Download the app in the App Store for iTunes or Android. We'll love to hear from you. Okay, it's another powerful experience, and like I always say, I love you. I truly love you, and you can't do a damn thing about it. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. I love you. Black Fire Podcast. Let's go.
It's not a game. It's a lifestyle. We global. BashaniRadio.com. New York City. Always talking about everything.
We're taking over the radio.